Now, Eric has worked on not only the World Trade Center and the Empire State Building, which does get hit with lightning, as well as his tower in Plainview. So tell us your view on proper grounding of radio towers, Eric. KE2EJ, the chief engineer of PBS locally, K2RIW in the TechNet. I'm hearing him on the input. I'll tell you what he says when he finishes.
One was for the electrical system, one was for lightning protection for the mast. They were identical in size and identical in length. It's actually more complicated than that, but that's sort of the basic idea. Every location should have a stake that goes into ground. You've got a remote channel, ground it there. You've got a main count, that's grounded previously. As he was talking about the telephone company, because everything has resistance, you wind up with difference of potential. You always want to maintain a local ground at point of entry. K2RIW, K2J.
Comment on lightning?
Okay, beautiful, Eric. Came through with 3% noise, 90% audio that time. 97% audio, very well. Person with comment on lightning, please give us your call letters and name, and then give us your lightning comment, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, Dick, you're switching. K2RIW. Your nicknamed me living on Sizzle Lane. Over.
Okay, Richie, KC2LTY. You said you had a lightning comment. Go ahead with that one, Richie.
Yeah, I've been struck by lightning 6 times. You nicknamed me living on Sizzle Lane. Remember that? Over.
Okay. Richie on Sizzle Lane, K2LTY. It's not a conversation you and I have had in the last month, therefore, because I'm kind of forgetful, Richie. Bring me up to speed. You've been struck with lightning many times. You live on Sizzle Lane. Give us a few more hints. How did you get struck with lightning so many times? What kind of damage occurred? Back to you, Rich.
No, you nicknamed me living on Sizzle Lane. I live on Searing Avenue. Next thing being on Sizzle Lane. That was maybe 2 years ago. No, I've been struck at least 6 times. I had a fire, burned holes through water pipes, quite a few times. There's no way to guard lightning. If it's going to get you, it's going to get you. Over.
Now, what do you believe, Richie? You live in Mineola. What is unique about your location in Mineola? There's some local radio towers, and Mineola, to my knowledge, doesn't have any local mountains. How would you be struck so many times, and did you have separate grounding on the radio equipment that got struck? Back to you, Richie.
Well, 50% of the time it grounded, 50% wasn't, and it feeds from the Long Island Railroad, 250 to 300 feet from a water tower, in the Ola. Other than that, I don't know.
As I said earlier, there are certain places on Long Island, for reasons that are mysterious. One of them was in the North Shore on Glen Cove area, and it looks like Mineola might be another one where lightning tends to strike rather frequently for mysterious reasons. So the general comment I'm hearing is that each one of your radio towers, when you got remote shacks and things like that, remote towers should have local grounding. And there's a little bit of a controversy now as to how you do or don't tie those grounds together between the power that comes through the main panel of the house and however it gets to the remote panel that's in the radio shack that's in the backyard. Looks like there's a little bit of a controversy there as to how we do that grounding. And I'm in favor of tying those grounds together. Vito thinks we should not tie those grounds together. Obviously, we're going to all do a little bit more research on this and find out the right way to go. I know this is a little bit confusing, Angel, but I'm getting the impression you can't have too many grounds. KC2, Echo Romeo Romeo, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Angel.
Roger there. I got a good picture of it. I'm looking at it like the way it's like sharing. So I believe it's not good to share, especially when you have different systems. You have your radio system, which is RF, and then you have your lighting system. So I wanted to say, sometimes you want to take the cheap path and do it this way, but I think it's best to stick another rod there and connect that to the lighting arrestor and all that stuff that got to do with lighting. And then the radio protection equipment, let that be separate. Even though they may be connected on the ground, but it's not really all into that same connections, because if they're connected to one wire to the other one, they'll be connected there. But if they're not connected, they're connected to the ground, there's not a real connection right there. So at this point, I believe I should go with two grounds, and that'll solve my case with the ground system in the shed. Thank you very much. And the next one was the crossband. What's the best procedure to use a crossband on 2 meter 440?
Dick, who just called me?
Okay, sure, Jay. The cross connection of grounds is not a bad thing, as long as they're separated from your electrical supply. You can hook your grounds directly to ground at multiple points, as long as you have a local path to ground. So if you have, say, coming out of the main house with three wires, one being power, one being neutral, one being a ground, that ground's going to connect to your remote box, which you are also going to connect a local ground to. So in that case, I agree with you in having the more grounds, the merrier.
Combat 6?
KC2, QIQ with a comment.
I think you didn't finish, Eric. Eric first, go ahead.
No, I pretty much said what I was going to say.
Okay, I think we've got Richie and Glenn in that order with some further comment. Go ahead, Richie.
Okay. I have a separate ground rod, 8 foot, from the electrical panel, right to the meter, into the ground. And I have another 8 foot rod in the ground of the antenna map in the back of the house. I haven't been hit lately, but I'm sure it's coming soon. So I have no other way to add to the safety. If it's going to get you, it's going to get you. This is what we want.
Okay, thank you for the information, Rich. Glenn has lived in Florida, and Gainesville, Florida is considered the lightning capital of the United States. And although Glenn didn't live in Gainesville, he wasn't powerful far from there, so he's lived with lightning throughout his days. Let's see how he has survived it. KC2QIQ, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Hey, good evening, Dick, and good evening, everybody. I'm kind of listening in the background and, you know, getting a little bit of input from what other people have experienced with lightning, and many of these things I've kind of already been through, been there, done that. And, you know, I think what it really comes down to for us as ham radio operators is that most of us are living in residential, non-commercial structures, and we're basically interested in keeping ourselves safe and how we ground things. And one of the key things that I think is very, very important that isn't always intuitive to most people is that your grounding systems, you really don't want to be, you don't want to have a grounding system inside your living area. In other words, anywhere you're home. Let me let this drop for a second. All of your grounding should be, as Eric described earlier, outside of, in other words, near the entry point. In other words, wherever any electrical wires or systems come into the house. So if you have a cable wire coming into the house, before the cable wire comes into the house, you want the ground rod right there. Before the electrical service comes into your house, you want the ground rod right there. If you're using an antenna system on your house, that antenna ground rod should be outside the house. In other words, the worst thing you want to do is basically have an antenna system up on the roof or a tower or something like that ungrounded, and then basically having the ground inside your living area. Let's say you had a basement, and you drill the hole and you tap the ground rod in your basement or you attach to a cold water pipe. Now what basically is happening is you're drawing the lightning into your house, into your living area. That's a real no-no. You really want to keep lightning outside. In other words, outside of your living structure. So if it's a general rule, the key thing is whenever you're putting ground rods in, 12 feet off the foundation outside the house and terminate any wires, coax, any cables, rotor cables, anything, that all those wires are all grounded outside the structure, your living area, before they enter into your ham shack. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I have a comment on that one.
Okay, Richie, go ahead.
I had an antenna up, not grounded. The coax came into the house, went over a water pipe, and it was laying on the basement. Struck by lightning, it came through the coax, put a hole in the water line, started a fire, and there was a burn mark on the basement floor the size of a silver dollar. So, yeah. If you're going to ground something, don't make sure it's outside. I agree 100% with that. Like I said, I had a motor lightning come into the house, into my basement. Started a fire, and then it burned all night. Everything that at the moment is grounded outside of the house immediately to the point where electrical panel outside where the meter is, boom, is the ground rod. Okay? The antenna comes down to mass the ground rod. That's the way to go. I agree with that. Please report to the question.
Okay, to a good one.
Okay, we're hearing now each one of the people who have a successful versus an unsuccessful system are saying make sure that all the lightning grounding is external to the living quarters. K2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, that's absolutely correct. And if you have an antenna mounted on your roof, you want a really nice ground line going outside your roof, down the side of the house, to your ground stake. That's number one. Number two, I think we really have to help people define what is a lightning strike, because a direct lightning strike leaves a real mess. Now, I've got a tower that's, you know, really strong structure, and I want thicker than what most people can imagine. And when we get direct lightning strikes, and I know Bernie can tell you, he saw me last week reworking my ground system, because I had a direct lightning strike. Now, this is a massive structure, and so these things clamped. And I found that the clamp had disintegrated the connection between the tower and the rod. That's a direct lightning strike. But you can have near lightning strikes, induce large bolts, and you can talk about that. We'll help people understand a little bit how you can damage radios and stuff without having a direct lightning strike, which is usually the majority of the cases. K2RIWK, too, John.
Yeah, the first half of that transmission, Eric, was quite good. The second half started getting noisy. You were moving the handy-talkie to a not-so-good location, but we heard it all. And so what Eric is really saying is that a direct lightning strike, which if it's just an ordinary lightning bolt, is 11,000 amperes for some number of microseconds. If it happens to be one of those positive polarity clouds that went by your house, that could be, in some cases, 100,000 amperes of the direct strike. Each one of us who have suffered lightning damage, very rarely is it a direct strike. If it strikes something 50 feet away, the Lenz's law, the Faraday's law, electromagnetic coupling, in other words, during that 11,000 to 50,000 ampere current that flows through that lightning bolt into that tree 50 feet away from your tower, in the process that high current flowing through that tree sets up a local, transient, very strong magnetic field. That magnetic field couples into the wiring of your house and your tower and your coax cables and so on. And so the EMP, the electromagnetic pulse of nearby strike, is what we get experiencing, I'm guessing, 90% of the time. very few of us get a really direct strike. You get a really direct strike, Eric is telling you that even extremely stoochy grounding can become damaged and you had to replace it. I think that's essentially what you were saying, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
No, man.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Eric. Go ahead.
All right. Now, the structure that's my tower is made of very, very, very heavy metal. And you would think that that thing is well grounded. And we have this additional grounding system, which, as I said before, in case why else would tell you, when you came over to the station, you saw me reworking my grounding system, because I had suffered a direct lightning strike. And these are very, very heavy straps of copper that hook the base of the tower to the ground system. And the ground system itself, many of the clamps that hold the feed lines, the ground lines to the rods themselves had disintegrated from the current that was passing through it. So that's why I brought up the fact that most people do not suffer a direct lightning strike. They suffer the effects of lightning. You can even have the effect of lightning from cloud to cloud induce great voltages into your antenna system.
I'll provide with a question.
Yeah, the next person who wanted to make a comment before Rich was, I think it was Vito, to be 2PJF, K2RIW.
Yes, a comment, if I may. A couple of things. He's talking about the flux density field, not the flux capacitor, by the way. I'm making a joke. But the flux density field that does build up around a strike, which can be just as detrimental as a strike itself in some cases. One quick thing that I do every time I complete my evening on the air, I open every coaxial cable. I separate the coax going to the radio equipment from that going to the antennas. And that, I feel, is another small insurance policy, but is an idea that everyone should do. Do not keep the antennas connected. Separate them. Open them at night, if I may, if that's going to be of any help to anyone. Back to you, Dick.
Glad to hear that, Vito. A number of people who really believe in belt and suspenders and really want to do conservative disconnect all their cables from all of their equipment every night. I've never done it. I've never suffered any radio damage. And I've got a 100-foot tower on 300 feet of land in Huntington. Maybe I'm lucky. Each of my antennas does have the equivalent of a ground by way of the coax cable. I'm not an HF person. I don't have a great big quarter wave ground plane sticking up in the air connected to only the center conductor of the coax cable, if you know what I mean. I'm a VHF, UHF person, so each of my antennas, with rare exception, have a natural ground built into the antenna. For the most part, if I put a ohm meter between the center conductor and the shield of the cable in the shack, by way of the antenna on the other end, they are grounded together. That's part of how I think I've suffered no real lightning damage, even though I did have what I believe is a nearby strike of the power line. Rich wanted to make one more comment before we leave this particular subject. KC2LTY, K2RIW.
And KC2QIQ with one more comment.
Rich first. Go ahead, Rich.
Yes, Ed. My question is, why is it that the Nassau County Police Department in Garden City has a very tall tower? I'm sure they've been hit by lightning more than once. And why is it that during a thunderstorm, if they were hit, that their equipment is not knocked off? They were always on the air. What do they have that we don't?
I'm guessing in their radio room they've got a liberal sprinkling of lightning arresters of the polyphaser-like design. I'm guessing that each of their VHF, UHF antennas have a natural ground built into them, a well-designed station master-like antenna. If you put an ohm meter between center conductor and ground, they really are connected together DC-wise, not RF-wise. Their transmission lines are probably a three-quarter inch or inch-and-a-half Andrew Heliax hardline, solid outer copper conductor on the transmission line, bonded to the tower. The base of the tower is well grounded with the grounding rods. You do all these things just right, and it's a rare circumstance where you suffer radio damage. Nothing is perfect. If one of those really potent 100,000 ampere positive lightning bolts hits that tower, even with all that protection, they might suffer some radio damage. But I'll bet you they've done a whole lot of things correctly, obvious by the success they're having. And I'll bet you the people in Florida have to really work at grounding. I know you've told me, Glenn, that they, even though you were using surge protectors on your computing equipment, I think you had to periodically replace them because the local lightning would damage them every time a major thunderstorm came by. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2J with another comment.
Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, Dick. When you start analyzing lightning, as I had done down in Florida quite a bit, I learned quite a bit about it, is that one of the biggest offenders for damage, believe it or not, isn't your antenna system. You know, generally, if you ground your antenna system outside the house, it's the least offender of all. In most cases, that's not where the lightning comes in. 90% of the time, where all the damage is taking place, is it's coming in through your power line. That's why having that really good, as a matter of fact, all the new standards now are 10-foot rods on the and the minimum of 6-gauge wire on the inlet line where your power feed cable comes in. Old structures that aren't completely up to code with the latest wiring are definitely much more susceptible than new structures. Let me let it drop for a second. Also, cable entry lines, your telephone lines, where they enter, the grounding there is extremely important. But another interesting thing is that the telephone companies now, the cable companies, and even the power companies have gotten better with putting suppression devices right at the entry points, which is also a very, very good thing, so that if anything does take place, it happens right at the entry point and gets resolved either by disconnecting, opening the circuit, shutting the power off, or doing something right at that point before anything comes into the living structure. So also very, very important things to be concerned about. But that was the reason I actually brought the question on. The thing I wanted to mention, too, is that in very, very severe lightning, one of the things that we don't really deal with much here on Long Island, but to keep in mind is that one of the grounds inside your house that's almost natural is your cold water pipes and your waste drain pipes. And it's always a good idea not to use your sinks or your faucets during electric storms. Just avoid them until that lightning passes. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Particularly if you live in Florida. Eric, each time you transmit to us, Eric, the beginning of your transmission sounds good on signal-to-noise ratio. Then as you talk, you slowly move the handy-talkie, and it starts becoming noisy. So wherever you start off, please stay there. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, well, I'm in the car now, Dick. Don't worry about it. The thing that I wanted to mention is, in terms of the commercial radio installations, not only are the towers grounded, but the Heliax line, at various points, that's installed properly, the Andrew sells actually strapping kits, where you take a section of the line that comes down, you wrap this very, very heavy gauge, flat copper around it, you bond it to it, and you seal it, and that gets bonded to the tower. Also, as you mentioned, station masters and all commercial antennas basically are at DC ground, so they don't really, what am I trying to say, they really don't pass the effect of the lightning bolt traveling down the center conductor of the coax. It always winds up on the outside. If you get a direct lightning strike to, say, a station master, basically the thing opens up like a fuse, so that prevents entry. But in all the commercial installations, you'll find polyphases on each one of those lines coming into the building, and usually it's mounted on a copper panel with exceptionally heavy grounding lines going through. several rather large grounding stakes. And Glenn's comment about being in the house during the lightning, during lightning activity is actually a wise suggestion. But you'll also find in the newer homes that they no longer use the cast iron pipe. The drain system is PVC, and in the newer homes, all the water supply is with PEX. So you don't have the direct conductivity, but you still have the conductivity through the water itself, which is not all that conductive, but it's good enough. K2RIW-KATJ.
I thank you, Eric. I know you've got a further question, Angel, with reference to cross-banding on 2 meters and 440. We're going to have to skip that one for now. We're going to have to come back to that the next time we get a chance to talk to you, because now it's time we should go over to the mailbag before it gets too late. KC2WGB, K2RIW and TechNet. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening again, Dick, and everyone on the net. I'll keep it short tonight because I know we're going to have a long session with Paul, so a couple of quick ones. I have one here from a gentleman named Glenn. He wants to know, what is an electrically operated enunciator, and what is it used for? You remember those, Dick?
Maybe I don't. Electrically operated. Now, there's something called a speech synthesizer, which some of our rigs have, where it'll talk to you and tell you what frequency you're on, what button you just pressed. I've got one of those in my Kenwood 751. But, you're going to have to tell me what an enunciator is, John.
Sound alert.
Okay, let's see. Eric, go ahead. Tell us what an enunciator is.
In the industrial and commercial world, they used to use fibers, but nowadays they use sound alerts, which is basically, you have a fire alarm, or you have a piece of equipment that has a fault indicator. Sound alert generally puts out a sound between 2 and 3 kilohertz that's very loud and very piercing. And in the commercial and industrial world, that's an enunciator.
Okay, my smoke detector and my carbon monoxide detector also put out a very piercing sound. Is that considered a kind of enunciator, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Anything that alerts a human being to a problem can take many forms, but the typical way it's been done for the last, ever since Mallory invented it, except the last 30 years now, it has been some form of what they call a sound alert, which is a trademark for the device, but I think the patent on that has expired, and now hundreds of different manufacturers make similar types of devices. But yeah, anything that announces that you need some information, that's what's called an enunciator.
I believe many commercial airliners have a stall indicator, a wing ice indicator, things like that. Would you consider that an enunciator also, Eric?
Absolutely.
Okay, so enunciators are putting out a characteristic tone that alarms the operator that he better take corrective action, better do something different. So these enunciators are usually tones, they're not necessarily a voice recording, although I do know that the B-52 pilots, in order to make sure that you got their attention, I know that they set up a system by which a sexy female voice would tell the B-29 operator, the B-52 operator, engine number 3 is on fire. Is that an enunciator? K2EJ, K2RIW?
As I said, it comes in all forms. And it doesn't even have to be oral. It can be mechanical. I know in some, I think it's in the A410s, in the European version of our airline, they actually shake the stick.
I've heard of those yoke shakers to let you know that you're in a stall condition. And that flight from Brazil back to France, they were getting indications like that, and they did not properly interpret them. and they ended up crashing in the water. So, looks like we've learned a little bit more about what are enunciators and what various forms they come into, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, Eric hit it almost right on the head. Originally, they were used in, especially like in hotels and phone switching, and even in large mansions, for the service staff, there would be an enunciator display in the kitchen or in the servants' quarters so that when a person pressed a bell or a button up in their room, there would be a little solenoid that would prop a little flag and let them know that that person needed attention. So how this gentleman ran across one of these, I don't know, but interesting question. But Eric had it right. KC2WGB. Let me get to the next one.
Oh, just want me to add that today's, or at least the last 30 years, the typical audible enunciator is a piezoelectric device. He's supplied it with the DC voltage, and it makes this very high pressure, you know, many dBs. You may use things like about 100 dB of sound pressure.
KC2QIQ.
Very fine, Eric. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, one of the places where I've noticed that that they've really have a very big importance is in hospitals. Usually attached to all the hospital beds, there's usually a little button that lights up back into the, with both sometimes a light panel and sometimes a noise, back to the nursing station to alert the nursing staff that someone inside the hospital needs assistance. KC2QIQ.
Good to know. You got it, John.
Okay, Dick, number two. This is an interesting question. Gentleman has a brick oscillator, similar to the one I have. It's an HP, standalone. And he wants to know, think up two signal generators to make sure they stay in phase. He wants to divide that signal. What should he use as a splitter, or what should he make if he has to make something? He will then take that signal and turn off the internal oscillators, which are all 10 megahertz, and put that into the external oscillator input so that he has both generators right on the money. He's worried about the division of the signal, reducing it to a point where it may not run, so what would be the most effective way to do it? KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
To really do this right, you got to read the manual on the signal generator, and read the section telling you what is the minimum requirement in dBm, milliwatts, let's call it, on the external reference input connector. If it requires a signal of greater than 0 dBm, in order to guarantee that the external reference will do what it's supposed to do, you better supply that amount of power. I think I've seen them as light as minus 10 and as high as plus 10 dBm in requirement. So that requirement is your first priority. Your second priority is to now find out what is the power output of your brick oscillator assembly. If it's putting out 0 dBm, and if each one of your inputs to your signal generators require plus 3 dBm, you can't get there from here. Plus 3 dBm is 2 milliwatts. 2 milliwatts supplied to each of two signal generators is 4 milliwatts total. Your signal generator puts out 0, which is only 1 milliwatt, you ain't going to make it without putting an intermediate amplifier. So even before you worry about how you divide the signal, worry about signal levels first, and know that you can't violate conservation of energy. As total power required has got to be less than the total power you've got from the oscillator if you're not willing to put in an amplifier. That's number one. Number two, once you meet the minimum requirement with some leeway, I mean, if it requires 0 dBm or greater, and you can only put 0 dBm exactly in there, you got to worry a little bit about whether or not it's going to give you a guaranteed reference lock of that synthesized signal generator. So you'd like to have a little leeway if you can. Once you guarantee you've got the leeway, now how you do the power dividing, the Cadillac approach is with a real power divider, Wilkinson or quadrature hybrid type power divider, 3 dB hybrid if it's quadrature, or Wilkinson power divider. That's a Cadillac approach. And if you buy a good one, the insertion loss of that thing is like half a dB. In other words, if I'm using a good brand of Wilkinson hybrid, and if it's guaranteed to have half a dB of insertion loss, be careful how you use that now. Half a dB of insertion loss beyond the conservation of energy. And there's two different ways they could give you that spec. Because it's dividing the power, one input common port to two output ports. If they give you the simplistic answer, they'll tell you that the insertion loss is -3.5 dB. In other words, from the common port to any one of the outputs would be 3.5 dB of loss. 3 dB because you're dividing the power 2 to 1, another 0.5 dB of the true I squared R insertion loss of the device. Well, there's another kind of not so scrupulous manufacturer of that Wilkinson hybrid who will tell you it has 0.5 dB of insertion loss. He may tell you 0.5 dB of excess insertion loss. That's what he's really talking about. You know you're going to get 3 if it's an equal power divide. Half power, 3 dB of loss. And its real internal resistive loss is another 0.5 dB above that. So now, does your signal generator, your brick, if it started off with +6 dBm, and I'm going into a Wilkinson hybrid where I'm going to get 3.5 dB of loss on each of the ports, which means I'll have +2.5 coming out of each of the ports, and if the signal generators require 0, I'm in like Flynn. So even before you worry about how you do the dividing, worry about the power levels that are achievable, even if you had the most ideal divider. In some cases, in a pinch, you could use nothing more than a T connector. If at the brick oscillator you had a simple BNC T connector, or an SMA T connector, yes, that creates a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. But if your brick oscillator has a good output isolating amplifier, the fact that it's going to see a 2-to-1, the fact that it's going to see a 2-to-1 insertion or a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is not necessarily bad, and it would tolerate that very nicely. The only thing wrong with the T connector is it gives you no isolation. Any signal coming out of signal generator number 1 going into signal generator number 2 will not be attenuated.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So the good news about the T connector is it gives you an inexpensive component that you probably got in your junk box. The bad news is it gives no isolation and it creates a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. In some cases, that's okay. In some cases, that could give you some grief. So those are some of the answers on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, that makes sense. If I was this gentleman, I would use a T-connector and establish a frequency and see if both counters read and if they maintain accuracy. He has one generator very similar to mine. It has the ability to put an external oscillator into it, but it doesn't have a sampling port. When they have sampling ports, the problem is very simple. You just tie it to the next one and lock out that particular oscillator. But you brought up some very good points. I'm sure he's going to have to play with that. He may have to use some kind of an amplifier to boost that signal up. But I think if he uses a divider, which is a high-quality one, and then use his instrumentation to measure and see how it's going, I think he can do what he needs to do, but it's going to take a little craftiness. We're just going to cover two tonight, Dick. I'll throw it over to Paul, and I'll throw it back to you. Give it to Paul, and we'll go on to the space thing. I'll save the other ones for next week. KC2WGB.
Hi, thank you, John. Alrighty. As you guys know, the Spirit... here we go. Spirit and Opportunity are the ones that were put down a few years ago. Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory, a couple of pounds shy of 2,000 pounds of hardware placed onto Mars after the 7 minutes of terror last Sunday evening from my point of view, but it really was early Monday morning, Eastern Standard Time. I think it started off as 5,000 pounds of hardware in space that first hit the atmosphere with its heat shield, eventually abandoned the heat shield, opened the parachute, eventually abandoned the parachute, turned on the sky crane, and then the sky crane turned on its 8 rockets at first, 4 rockets later on, lowered it another 10 or 20 meters to the surface by way of a nylon or a Kevlar rope of some kind, lowered it to the surface, and everything worked, and they started getting pictures back, and I was a little bit disappointed that over-the-air broadcast gave very little coverage of it. The news reports the next morning gave you more coverage, but live coverage over-the-air broadcast had very little. I know that there were some cable channels, and NASA channel, I'm sure, covered it very well. By way of websites, there are lots of websites you could go to. So give us a little bit of rundown, and I'll tell you some of the things after you talk, Paul, what I've discovered about some of the magic that goes on inside of the Curiosity spacecraft. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. This is WS2N. Yeah, it was a pretty good night. Naturally, I stayed up. 1:31, just a few seconds after that, it actually landed. It was almost 14 minutes before that. We got the radio signals back, and they sure went wild at JPL. JPL is where they handle all these flights. That's like mission control for these deep space missions in Pasadena, California. And they went wild for about a good 15 minutes before they went back to their desk and to their computer screens. So it was fun. It was fun to see that everything that we talk about on this net starting, I guess, in 04 when the Spirit and Opportunity landed, that we pretty much described everything that was going to go on. It worked out that way. Oh, yeah, they had backup procedures that they didn't need to do in case this happened or that happened. But it wound up 100%. They wound up a mile and a half away from dead center. Let me drop it. The ellipse originally started out as 12 miles by a certain width, and that shrunk down to about 6 or 4 miles, and they wound up in pretty much dead center of that. So that's pretty good. I mean, they had control over this thing. John was talking about the weights that they have attached to the outside of the spacecraft, and these things were thrown off. I know John was wondering if how many were used or whatever. From my so all of them were used. So as this thing is coming down, it's weighted to one side, and eventually the computer throws it off. And they have imprints. Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter is taking pictures of not only the spacecraft itself, Curiosity, but the back shell. They got pictures of the sky crane that flew away after it landed. They have pictures of even the where the weights, these heavy weights landed on a Martian surface. So it's all detailed. They had pictures of the parachute coming down from Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Drop it. Could have a shot at that because they did the same thing with the Phoenix spacecraft. They did have a picture of that parachute coming, you know, as that thing was going down to the surface a couple of years ago when that thing landed. That was not a robot, it just stayed in one position, but it was very valuable because they did find water and ice there. So it all worked out very well. The communications wound up very good. They have basically 3 transmitting receiving antennas on that whole setup. One at the pointy part of the spacecraft, you know, where the parachute is located. And that transmits X-band and UHF. And, in fact, if you look at the cruise stage, this thing was sitting in the cruise stage. It's basically, it looks like a hole, you know. The cruise stage has all these solar panels all over it as it was going from Earth to Mars. And the center is missing. And it turns out that one of the reasons for that is there's an antenna there. And on the way to Mars for the first, you know, month or so, they used that antenna. And eventually they switched over to a secondary antenna during the rest of the cruise flight. And then that antenna became very important again when it went through the EDL as it entered the atmosphere. That antenna started transmitting again directly back to the deep space network at Earth, on Earth. And also when the Odyssey and Mars Global Surveyor got into the wake of the UHF transmission, they were able to pick up the signal and in Odyssey's case retransmit back in the Cape the X-band back to back directly to Earth. I think it was between 4 and 6 gigahertz. But that all went very well. Everything separated. The back shell eventually came off it with the parachute, and that took the antenna with it. It switches over to an antenna located on the sky crane, this gigantic backpack that you were talking about with all the rockets all over it, and it was transmitting using that antenna that has an amplifier and everything on board. And all these antennas also can receive signals from Earth or from Odyssey in Mars orbit. And again, with the communications, when the rover started dropping, and it dropped on nylon cords. In fact, it had three nylon cords off this cone-like device that lowered it. And then it also had the data and power cables attached to it. Those things were eventually cut after it landed. Well, even on that last little bit, the antenna was switched over to the UHF onboard Curiosity. And then this thing flew away. When it flew away, that spool that let it down, it had springs on it. Let me drop it. And those springs started to wind these cables back up real quickly. They didn't want it if the sky crane dropped a little bit, they didn't want these dangling cables, to get caught in a wheel or something. Or get caught on the rover. So it spooled up real quick, and then of course the thing took off and eventually crashed far away from the Mars Science Laboratory. So it all went good. I figured we'd start off with that information about the past. And if you want, Dick, we could talk about the future. What this thing has on board is unbelievable when you start looking into it. And as far as websites and all, yeah, I watched the NASA on the computer, NASA TV, blew the screen up, full screen. It was great. Back to you, Dick. What did you think of it? WS2N.
If you know what you're looking at, it was very enjoyable. You can tell that they were very worried because 76 pyrotechnic devices all had to fire at just the right time for the 6 different configurations it had during the encounter, descent, and landing, EDL. Those titanium weights that were on board, I think it was a total of 4 of them. When they got rid of 2 of them, they intentionally created an imbalance in this cone-shaped craft. The craft looks a little bit like an Apollo command module coming in with its heat shield, but when they discarded the 2 titanium weights, it now was imbalanced, and it was a little bit tilted off to one side because the center of gravity had shifted. And as they rotated the craft, it literally was doing a kind of surfing. In other words, if you study the way the space shuttle does a precision landing with the microwave beam scanning landing system that was made generated by Airborne Instruments Laboratory, there's a very specific S-shaped curve in the landing sequence you go through, and depending on whether your altitude is too high or too low, or you're a little too far east or too far north, you slightly change the parameters of that S-shaped curve in order to make a precision landing and find the center of the runway. And they were doing the equivalent of that. They were doing a kind of surfing. In other words, because the entering craft with its heat shield, let me drop, was really being, the center of gravity was shifted a little bit off to one side. Therefore, it was coming down with a small amount of lift. In other words, it was slowly deflecting itself in one direction. And by rotating the craft at the right rate, you could make it come down as a spiral, or you could make it favor going to the east or favor going to the north, depending on which direction you rotated and how long you stood there. Once they knew that they were on target, and obvious by how close they got to the center of the landing ellipse, once they knew they were essentially on target, then they jettisoned the other two titanium weights, and now the thing was thoroughly balanced from then on. Lowest possible moment of inertia, lowest possible mass, least amount of asymmetry, and it came straight in after that, once they knew they were on target, so to speak. Very nicely designed system. And when you look at the Mars MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, I guess it's called, and the Odyssey pictures, you can see they found every piece of the hardware. They found where the six weights impacted Mars. They found where the sky crane impacted Mars. They found the heat shield. They found the parachute. All this stuff was laying on the ground far away from the actual Mars Science Laboratory. Very nicely done operation. Tell us a little bit about what do you think it's going to do in the future, and I'll tell you about another website I found if you want to dig into the specifics. Just by going to NASA.gov and Mars, you get a lot of information and a lot of pictures. But if you first go to Mars.jpl.nasa.gov and you start opening up those websites, my goodness, do you start getting interesting information about the RAD, the DAN, and all these other pieces of hardware. I'll tell you a little bit about that after I send it back to Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, yeah. JPL is really good. On all their flights, they have a terrific amount of information. And you bring up a lot of PDF files and some of them are like books and have diagrams. You can really get lost in some of the hardware that they put up there. You know, but not only for this mission, all the missions they've done them all. You know, Cassini and Galileo, and I mean they go way back to Voyager. They go back to the Ranger days when they had the spacecraft crashing into the moon for the first time. That's where they got the peanut habit too, you know, right before something critical like EDL. Everybody opens the peanuts, and that becomes a standard there. It dates way back 50 years. But the equipment, yeah, they have 10 pieces of equipment on board. Well, actually, 9 now. One of them was on the heat shield. But, you know, you have the chem cam, that's the one that I think gets most of the attention. That's got the laser beam on it. It's going to fire it at rocks. We could talk about that in detail on how that all works. And then the spectrometer inside, a telescopic lens that takes pictures of it. You can tell what it's made of. But there's a lot more information about that. You could probably spend the whole net on each topic. And you've got the APEX. Let me drop it. APEX is the... I don't know how they pronounce it, but it's the APEX. I think I call it the APEX, but that's the alpha particle X-ray spectrometer. It's been on all the flights. It's even been on Pathfinder, that little microwave-sized robot they put up there in '97, and of course it's been on Spirit and Opportunity. Of course, this is a much more advanced one. It's located on the arm. Got a, by the way, the arm is about 2 or 3 feet bigger than the ones on the previous rovers.
and on the end of this arm, and it's a very heavy arm. I don't know, I had to get rid of 70 pounds or something on Earth, and this thing's going to be the thing with the drill in it and the scoop and all. Well, it also has the this X-ray spectrometer on board, and that could quickly tell what the rocks are made of. Gives them an idea, you know, before they really decide let's break out the drill or scoop, you know, let's find something really unusual. This thing's going to tell them on the quick side too, because they've improved on this. The old one on board Spirit, for instance, could pretty much only work at night, so they, because of the temperatures that were required to, you know, keep this thing cold and drop it. And what happens is this one here has got a bit of a improvement to it. It has they call it an electronic cooler. The only thing I could picture when they said that, I mean, that means it's not Freon or anything. I think it's probably maybe the pelty air type of device, you know, and they're able to use this thing actually in the daytime. And by bringing it closer to each specimen, they could spend a lot less time. The old ones, they'd have to spend like an hour or so. This thing would be able to do it in about one-third of the time, they said. So they can get a good idea of what the rock's made of before they even decide, hey, this is a good sample, let's try it. Then you've got the, on board, you've got a camera on board. That's another experiment. They call it the MALI, M-A-H-L-I. And that's the Mars Handling Imager. And very high resolution. Go from, like, down from, smaller than, like, a rock all the way to infinity. You know, smaller than a pebble. In fact, I've seen pictures already from the distance. They use that camera on one of the earlier shots that came back. And they've got other equipment on board. They've got this Kenman experiment, which is mounted inside the Curiosity next to the SAM. And this thing's got all kinds of discs on board. It's 27 different discs, so you got 27 different samples, and you put this little piece of sample the size of an aspirin there, and they'll be able to rotate it. They've got all sorts of caliber.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
One thing I wanted to mention, we were talking to John a couple weeks ago, and he had asked about a color reference thing on that would be located on the rover, whether or not it had it, and at the time I didn't know. But since then, I found out that it does have it. Spirit and Opportunity had it, and they could point the camera at it, and they get a good idea of what the what the colors are. They can calibrate things. But one of the things they're concerned about with this is the dust. A lot of it's like iron oxide, and it's kind of it's got a magnetic base to it. So what they did is they put like little magnets around this color wheel or whatever it is, and to keep any dust that does come down will keep away from this. In this way, they'll always have that as a calibration unit. So I thought that was pretty good. Another thing they have is the scientists want to be able to see what these rocks look like, and the atmosphere on Mars throws a different color at the rocks. You know, when you stand up there, if you were to stand there, you would look off and you would say, okay, that's a gypsum color a basalt, or you would just know as a geologist. They said that the pictures that come back, they sometimes can't tell. They want a quick reference before they make decisions. Let me drop it. What they have is they change the light. They can change the lighting of the pictures so that when the scientists look at it, it's as if they took the mountain range and put it on Earth, and then they look back at looking at the mountain range with our light, with the atmosphere that we have, and they could say, oh, I recognize that,
they'll get a quick idea of what they're looking at. I thought that was pretty neat. So all these different things, many more different pieces of equipment. Like I said, 10 different science equipment pieces that are on this. One of them is not there anymore because it was a bunch of pressure sensors and thermocouples that were attached to Curiosity's heat shield. They never did that before. It took all kinds of readings on the way down, and the readings were transmitted to the computer on board Curiosity. Eventually, that information will be sent up. The telemetry will go, of course, to Odyssey and back to Earth. So far, that's pretty much it. I'd like to cover the power source. That's an interesting topic. We've got to do that tonight. Back to you, Dick. WS20.
Okay, you know, one of the things that I was worried about also is that that nuclear power source, I've forgotten the MMRT, something or other, Mars mission, or RT, it's a radioactive thermal generator, RTG. It has a polonium, I think it's U-238, polonium-238, I think is the raw material, which is continuously giving off heat. It's giving off approximately 2,000 watts of thermal energy. You've got to have heat sinks to take care of that. That's the good news. That, in turn, is going into thermocouples, a whole string of those, and out of that comes somewhere around 110 to 150 watts, depending on which reference you go to. The electrical power to get out of the MMRTG is either 110 watts or 150 watts, but it's in that vicinity. That's the electrical power they've got to work with, and that electrical power is good for the next decade. I think after 6 years, I think it's going to be down a few percent because of the half-life of the nuclear material that's